Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy tonight. NovaM Radio. Streaming live at NovaMRadio.com. Number for calls, 800-989-1480. Looks like one of the I don't know. Is it really one of the rats? I mean, this guy had his hands on the steering wheel of this ship. Is jumping ship. Several months before this thing hits an iceberg, I guess. Karl Rove announced his resignation at the end of August. The Wall Street Journal reports Karl Rove, President Bush's longtime political advisor, is resigning as White House Deputy Chief of Staff effective August 31st. According to... this is precious. He said, I just think it's time, Mr. Rove said in the interview. There's always something that can keep you here, and as much as I'd like to be here, I've got to do this for the sake of my family. Wow. It's just a countdown now, I guess, until the divorce. And, you know, you got to admit, it's very difficult. Jeff Gannon leaves the White House years ago, and Karl Rove gets a lot more lonely. Here he is. Man, this just breaks you up. It really, guys, just so sincere. Let's play his goodbye. This is him at a press conference today. This is number 22.
I've seen a man of far-sighted courage put America on a war footing and protect us against a brutal enemy in a dangerous conflict that will shape this new century. I've seen a leader respond to an economy weakened by recession, corporate scandal, and terrorist attacks by taking decisive action to strengthen the economy and create jobs.
He's going to give more
I've seen
money
a
rich
reformer
people.
Who challenged his administration, the Congress, and the country to make bold changes to important institutions in great need of repair. I will miss, deeply miss, my work here, my colleagues, and the opportunity to serve you and our nation, Mr. President. But I look forward to continuing our friendship of 34 years, to being your fierce and committed advocate on the outside, and to the next journey we might make together. At month's end, I will join those whom you meet in your travels, the ordinary Americans who tell you they're praying for you. Like them, I will ask for God's continued gifts of strength and wisdom for you and your work, your vital work for our country and the world, and for the Almighty's continued blessing of our great country. Thank you again for this extraordinary opportunity.
Wow. I almost started crying there, folks. Oh, I'm at laughing. So there you have it, Karl Rove, getting while the getting is good, riding out of town while he's still avoiding subpoenas from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Patrick Leahy put out a press release saying that Karl Rove failed to comply with the Judiciary Committee subpoena to testify about the mass firings of the United States attorneys. He acted as if he was above the law. That is wrong. Now that he's leaving the White House while under subpoena, I continue to ask what Mr. Rove and others at the White House are so desperate to hide. The Senate Judiciary Committee will continue its investigation into this serious issue. There is a cloud over the White House and a gathering storm. A similar cloud envelops Mr. Rove even as he leaves the White House. So Karl Rove heading back to Texas, presumably looking for some of that right-wing... a dole, I guess. They'll put him to some crappy right-wing think tank. Will hire him, put him on the payroll, and presumably he's writing a book that will be a work of fiction. He doesn't keep any diaries. He's just going to remember it all from the top of his head. And I don't think this guy this guy would have to be Shakespeare or I don't know who he could be to rewrite history in such a way that will put his legacy in a favorable light as the years go on. Here's a guy whose main job was to destroy the policy apparatus of the White House, of the U.S. government, to destroy the notion of good governance, and to run, essentially, the administration and our entire government as some type of jackbooted thug version of the Republican Party. I mean, that's what this is all about. When the stories come out that this guy's been holding political indoctrination meetings for every agency in the executive branch, for foreign diplomats. Earlier this week, it came out that Gonzalez's top aides, Goodling and Sampson, attended political indoctrination meetings with Karl Rove, all in violation of the Hatch Act, turning the U.S. Justice Department into essentially a brown shirt extension of the White House. Corrupt justice in such a way that it will provide for some type of permanent majority. Well, I got news for you, Carl. You failed. You failed in a big, big way. And there you go. Ask not for whom the bell tolls. So Karl Rove failed in his attempt to make a one-party rule for years and years to come. Now, of course, he succeeded in seriously degrading the capacity of our government to do anything properly. And, of course, succeeded in stripping Americans of the civil rights, pushing through things like this FISA bill. Not to say that this exculpates any of the Democrats who voted for it. But one of the things he set out the door, and here it is. This is another prime example of Karl Rove just telling him the country what his strategy is. You know, when you look on why this FISA thing took place, obviously it's not to fight terrorism. The Bush administration had multiple opportunities to change the FISA law in a way that would fix it, according to Mike McConnell, coming off of these FISA court rulings that what the Bush administration was engaged in was illegal. And there were Democrats, even Russ Feingold, had signed on to fix FISA in that respect. Once the deal was made, Karl Rove's calculations were, all right, well, this is not going to be an effective political tool for us. We got to push it further. We got to make it so you don't need a warrant to spy on Americans. And unfortunately, the Democrats capitulated. Friday in the New York Times, Russ Feingold said in an interview that the White House, and this is, of course, before he knew that Karl Rove was leaving, and before Karl Rove leaving in an interview with Wall Street Journal, says he expects the president's approval ratings to rise again. Well, that's a joke. And that conditions in Iraq will improve as the U.S. military surge continues. We should be so lucky, but it's absolutely no evidence. All the evidence runs to the contrary, of course. And he said he expects Democrats to be divided this fall in the battle over warrantless wiretapping. That's what that FISA legislation was all about. That's what every move this White House has ever done. It's not based on policy. It's not based on keeping this country safe. It's not based on fighting a war of terrorism or war on terror, whatever it is they're calling it this week. It's all based on trying to gain some type of political advantage. Russ Feingold, New York Times on Friday, says that the White House has, quote, identified one of the major remaining weaknesses in the Democratic Party. And that's its unwillingness to stand up to the administration when it's making a power grab regarding terrorism and national security. There's too many of these blue dog Democrats, these corporatist Democrats, who buy into this entire frame. And frankly, the American public is way out ahead of them on this. They're way out ahead of them on the failure of this Iraqi occupation. They're way out ahead of them on the failure of this surge. And look, the American public knows what this is all about. This is just kicking the can down the road. And meanwhile, we're leaving these troops in there, and it's basically just providing cover for the Shia and Sunni, the various groups that are fighting amongst each other, to incubate an even greater civil war. We get a story when we come back about the Iraqi Interior Ministry trying to get more guns on the black market. This follows the report last week that 190,000 guns are missing, 30%. what the U.S. has handed out, missing. What are the chances that those guns are killing our U.S. military personnel? I'd say pretty high. We got to take a break. Numbers 800-989-1480. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. There you go, Karl Rove, easing on down the road. Just ambling off to Texas. Leaving in his wake a tremendous amount of destruction that we'll be cleaning up this guy's mess for years and years to come. Coming up in the next segment, I'll be talking to Josh Rushing. He is a former Marine who now works for Al Jazeera. He was in that documentary Control Room. He's got a book out, Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. He'll be joining us in the next segment. And later in the program, I'll be talking to Brett Netson from Built to Spill. They're on the road, and a couple of issues I wanted to talk to Brett about. Always good to get a perspective of a guy who's seeing what the kids are up to these days. Meanwhile, Spencer Ackerman on Talking Points Memo, Muckraker, quoting the AP, reports that there has been an uncovering of an attempted by the Interior Ministry in Iraq. I mean, this just gives you a sense that you could have a story like this, just how dysfunctional the Iraqi government is. And this notion that supposedly the surge is going to give time for the political situation on the ground in Iraq to improve is simply a joke. It's simply a joke. Last week, Iraq couldn't account for 190,000 pistols and AK-47s sent to the Iraqi army and police in 2004 and 2005 by the Americans. And now, apparently, Italian investigators have uncovered a deal to sell something like 100,000, 115,000, I guess it was 105,000 weapons. The Interior Ministry wouldn't discuss the AK-47 transaction on the record, but the official said that most of the 105,000 weapons were meant for police in Iraq's western province of Anbar. However, that raises questions because the Pentagon reports only 160,000 trained police across all of 18 Iraq's provinces. There's only 160,000 throughout the entire country. So the notion that all these are going to Iraqi military and cops, of course, is a joke. What they're doing is they're using the time that we are buying them now to arm each other for this coming onslaught. It's simply ridiculous. And, of course, this report comes on the heels of the war czar. He's the special deputy national security advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan, and on NPR on Friday, saying that maybe it's time for a draft. Here's number 13.
Given the stress on the military and the concern about these extended deployments for an all-volunteer military, can you foresee in the future a return to the draft?
You know, that's a national policy decision point that we have not yet reached, Michelle, because
But does it make sense militarily?
I think it makes sense to certainly consider it, and I can tell you this has always been an option on the table.
Ooh. Of course it's an option on the table. Obviously the plan by the Bush administration, keep this war going. Keep it going until George Bush exits Karl Rove. Meanwhile, I guess just paving the road for escape from Washington, D.C. Here's Representative Jan Schakowsky, Democrat from Illinois, just returned from a trip to Iraq. Here's her perspective on the surge. This is number 12.
I believe overall the surge is a failure. Why is that? because the purpose was defined as reducing violence to create a secure environment, to create the space for political reconciliation. And Iraq is as far from that as it's ever been. We met with the Deputy Prime Minister, Dr. Bam Saleh, who informed us that the evening before, former Prime Minister Alawi had pulled out from the cabinet, the Sunnis had pulled out before, and he said, and the kind of reconciliation that needs to be done won't be done this September, it won't be done next September, he said with his voice drifting off. It's clear to me that we cannot win someone else's religious civil war.
And she went on to say that General David Petraeus said we could be there for another 10 years. Another 10 years. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Josh Rushing. Oh, Sam Cedar, I'm sorry about that, folks. We had a little timing problem there. I heard some music coming in. So you got David Petraeus saying we got 10 more years to fight this counterinsurgency in Iraq. And, of course, this is the plan, folks. Permanent occupation of Iraq. A tremendous waste. We could be there for 50 years. Certainly longer than Saddam Hussein probably would have lived out his natural life. All right, like I say, when we come back, we'll be talking to Josh Rushing, author of Mission Al Jazeera. Build a bridge, seek the truth, change the world. He went from Marine spokesman for CENTCOM to reporter for Al Jazeera. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. On the phone, Josh Rushing, author of Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. Josh Rushing was a media liaison for the Marines during the initial invasion of Iraq, and he became the U.S. military's point person for the Arabic news network Al Jazeera. He ended up leaving the military and was subsequently offered a job with Al Jazeera International that he took. Welcome to the program, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Josh, you amazing story, and I remember watching you in, of course, the documentary Control Room that I guess came out a couple of years ago now, or a year and a half ago, maybe.
It came out in 2004, so a little longer than you think. I guess that'd be about 3 years, huh?
Exactly. And you have a real fascinating story. Let's start with... tell me when you joined the Marines and what were you doing prior to ending up in Doha?
Okay, let me see. I joined the Marines. I was 17 years old. That was in 1990. I was living in a small town in North Texas where I grew up, and I just graduated high school. The Marines made me a journalist so that I wrote for military newspapers and magazines during my enlisted years. I was enlisted for 9 years. During that time, I got a degree from the University of Texas in the classics and became an officer. And then they made me a media liaison, which led me eventually to Los Angeles, where I represented the Marine Corps in Hollywood, of all places. And from Los Angeles, I deployed for 6 months over to help with the invasion of Iraq. That was from January to July of 2003, and I was actually chosen to be one of Tommy Franks' spokespeople at U.S. Central Command, which is where the movie captured what I did there.
All right, now, what exactly did you do in Hollywood?
Yeah, all the services have an office in Hollywood. that assist in the productions of television and film. The office is meant to be an educational office, so that they, I guess essentially the government recognizes that Hollywood influences people's perception of what the military is and what it isn't. So if, let's say, you're working on the set of JAG or maybe a movie like Black Hawk Down, and you want to have military help for that movie, as long as the script has something educational about the military in it for the audience, then the military can provide anything from F-18s to tanks to troops or military advice at the cost of the producer, so that it doesn't cost the taxpayer anything, and yet the government isn't profiteering off of it.
And it also
that's the best use of the office. The worst use is it can be used for spin and propaganda and to
right.
shape, you know, entertainment projects.
So if there's something in the script that doesn't necessarily reflect well on the military, or is they leverage the use of those that equipment in the production, you don't get the tanks if you don't take out this scene, which may be a little bit brutal or may reflect poorly on the military.
Yes and no. I mean, if you look at the show JAG, it went on for 9 years, and I worked on it for three of them, which was much to my chagrin. But, you know, the entire show is based every week on a person in the military essentially doing something that breaks the law, the UCMJ, and is brought to trial. So it's not so much that you have a member doing a negative thing. It's that are you showing the institution to be
right.
corrupt or not? And in the end, if you show the institution to be okay, even though it has bad apples, that will generally gain support. But often it's left up to the personality of the person in that office. A great movie is A Few Good Men
mm-hmm.
with Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson. It's about a Marine squad that kills a weaker member. And then the murder is covered up all the way up to the colonel, who's played by Jack Nicholson, and he's a national hero. And this young lawyer challenges him in court and gets the truth out, and Nicholson's eventually arrested and taken away for the crime. That wasn't supported by my office years before I got there. Had I been in charge of the office, had that script come through when I was there, we would have supported that. Because at the end of the day, the institution did the right thing, even though there were some bad apples.
Right. Now it would just go up all the way up to, let's say, Rumsfeld, and they would take it out. But be that as it is.
There's actually the same civilian who's been doing this for years at the Pentagon and oversees all the offices. And he's a really reasonable guy. His name is Phil Stroop. And he's probably, I don't know how many years he's been doing it, long before I was there, and he's still doing it now. So there is a bit of consistency in it.
All right. So you head to Iraq. You are working in Qatar, I guess. As the spokesperson for Tommy Franks in Central Command, is that correct?
That's true. That's true. And I was on stations like Fox News or ABC or Xinhua or you name it every day, explaining why we were going to war and what we were doing.
Yeah. Now tell me about that, because I've read a couple of interviews with you, and I've read parts of your book at this point, and you really felt that you were compromised in that position.
I did. The best use of a military spokesperson is to explain the conduct of action. So it's going to explain why the military or how the military is doing something, not why it's doing it. But that office was used in a very political way. Before the invasion, there was a young political operative about 32 years old placed in charge of the office. Now, he displaced an Air Force colonel that had been doing media relations for the Air Force since he was, I don't know, probably 22 years old. He started in 1975 when this operative was about 3 years old. But now the young guy's his boss, and all the younger guy knows is how to run a campaign, not how to be a military spokesperson. So the office was run like a political campaign, like a Republican political campaign. And young troops in uniform, to include myself, were used to sell the war. So before the invasion, I would go out to a reporter to explain why the U.S. was going to invade another sovereign nation. That's unusual to have a young lieutenant in uniform explaining something of at that high of a political level, but that's the way it was done. And it was done that way because they knew the reporters couldn't ask me critical questions.
Right, because you're wearing the uniform, and then it's going to make it look badly on the reporter at that point.
Exactly. That's not what that reporter's audience wanted to see. That's not what their editorial staff wanted to see, their management. I mean, if you looked at MSNBC, their coverage was being packaged with a banner that said, "Our hearts are with you."
Mm-hmm.
Now, that banner would have appeared below the reporter and my face on the interview. Do you think he's going to ask me a critical question if his heart is with me? Probably not. Well, the Bush administration knew this, and they used that in the selling of the war, and I did it firsthand.
Now, was there a team of guys like you? I mean, this operative, this is Jim Wilkinson, is that correct?
It is, Jim Wilkinson. He's now the Secretary of Treasury's chief of staff, Henry Paulson's chief of staff.
And he made his bones with the Florida recount, didn't he?
He did. He before that, he worked in Dick Armey's office. He was the guy behind spreading the line about Gore inventing the Internet. And then he was on the Bush campaign in 2000, and during the recount down in Florida, he was in charge of the media down there. So if you Google something called the Brooks Brothers Riot.
Right, he's the one there. There are all those staffers down there in the suits saying, basically intimidating the people who are recounting the election down there.
You're right. And when you look at the news reports of that, it's Jim Wilkinson who comes out and says, wait a second, this wasn't organized. These were just a bunch of good Americans who felt like the voting process was being swept away from them, and they got a little too emotional. Because if it was organized, it breaks the federal law.
Yeah, exactly.
People across state lines to intimidate the voting process. So he was out there in the press making sure we all knew it wasn't organized, that this just happened to happen. But, yeah, that's where he really earned his bones with the Bush administration. He also was involved on September 14th when President Bush went to Ground Zero. And he had the bullhorn, and he shouted to the workers, you know, I hear you, and soon the rest of the world will hear you. Jim was the architect of that, and that was a big media moment for the Bush administration. He goes from that to being a part of the White House Iraq group with Condoleezza Rice, Scooter Libby, Andy Card, everyone else that was eventually involved in the Valerie Plame affair. Everyone in that group eventually was called in to testify in the Valerie Plame affair. Well, Jim goes from the White House Iraq group, which essentially is designed to figure out how do you sell the war, to being the information czar for Central Command and implementing the sale of the war.
So how many guys like you were under Jim Wilkinson at CENTCOM?
It's a large media operation, and you have to imagine he's actually in charge of all the public affairs guys who are in Qatar, Kuwait, Iraq, Afghanistan, the entire region all fall under him. So you're talking hundreds of them. Now, in our office particularly, there were several dozen, but everyone has different jobs. So the guys who were actually on camera, it boils down to maybe four or five guys, and I was one of those.
And did you have direct contact with him on a regular basis?
Daily.
And so was part of his job to make sure that you were toeing the line, too, not just to help you, but also to maybe watch you?
Well, I don't know if it's as much to watch me as to use me. His job was to sell the war. And we were the tools that he was given to sell the war with. Other people who came out of the White House Iraq group were to sell the war in other fashions, on the diplomatic level and the political level. His job was to use the military to do it, and I was one of those tools.
We're talking to Josh Rushing, author of Mission Al Jazeera. And so at what point, Josh, did you start to – did you have a – was there a specific moment or – what point did you start saying, hey, there's something really wrong here?
Well, you know, there were a couple points, but that was definitely one point. And to Jim's credit, I actually argued this and said, you can't do this, and here's why you can't do it. Because as soon as the guy in uniform starts to sound and look like a political flack, who's going to listen to him anymore? And the U.S. military enjoys a very high credibility with the U.S. people, and you're putting that credibility at risk. And Jim would actually let me argue that far more than a real two-star general. And I think I forgot to mention, he was actually given the equivalent rank of a two-star general. No real general would have let me argue it the way Jim did, but I lost that argument at the end of the day. But we were kind of constantly engaged in that discussion. So that was one thing I saw that clearly bothered me. The second thing was about Al Jazeera. It was about how little we understood about Al Jazeera and how that influenced the way we engaged with it or failed to engage with it, and then ultimately how dangerous that was.
And it was dangerous because, well, you know what, let's take a break, and we will come back and we will continue this conversation. Josh Rushing, author of Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. We will talk about how you went at that point from someone who I guess was somewhat disillusioned with his role as a military spokesperson to a reporter for Al Jazeera. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. We'll be right back.
stars and stripes we can tell.
Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on NovaM Radio. Streaming live at NovaMRadio.com. On the phone, Josh Rushing, author of Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. He was a media liaison for the Marines at CENTCOM and now a reporter for Al Jazeera. So, Josh, we were at the point where you become disillusioned in your role as spokesperson, both from a perspective that you are actually marketing the war to reporters. Just tell me a little bit about what reporters, what you experience from these reporters who are supposedly trying to get information from you.
You know, there's no sense of professional skepticism from them. They have bought into the message long before they got to Doha. I think, you know, they got there, they knew they needed access. Every reporter, this was their wars as much as it was any Marines or soldiers. They know that they could get their big break, their scud stud moment in the sun. So they were playing along to the point that Wilkinson would give me lines, WMD change, or there are WMDs there, regime change, or ties to terrorism. Any one of the main lines we were using to go out and sell that day, I would go out to a reporter, and a reporter would say, before we go on live national TV, are there any messages you want to get across today? I say, yeah, sure, WMD. And he goes, okay, great, here are the questions I'll ask you. And he had set up the interview with a number of softball questions. We'd do that interview live, and then he'd pat me on the back and thank me for my service.
Was there any particular news outlets that would do that more than others?
I have to say it depended on where the reporter came from. Probably more than the outlet, Fox, MSNBC, NBC were probably the worst about it.
Wow.
That said, that the two American reporters, that is, for American networks or bureaus, that didn't go along that way were CNN and AP. But I have to say, I think this might be as much a reflection on where these reporters came from as it was on any of the networks. The reporters from all the other networks had come from America to Doha, so they had been kind of trapped in that same echo chamber that America was in 2002, 2003. They all kind of had a similar attitude about the war. The AP reporter, Nicole Winfield, had come from Rome, where she worked in their bureau there, although she's American. And then Tom Mintier was a CNN reporter, but he was in the Bangkok bureau. So they had come from outside of America to Doha. And it created, clearly, not only understood this looking back on it, a different attitude that those reporters had, a sense of skepticism that had been washed away in most of the American reporters trapped within this environment.
That's fascinating. Now, so you went on to, so you left the military and you went on to become a reporter for Al Jazeera. How did that happen?
It's kind of a long journey. I got back and I was frustrated more about Al Jazeera than about the sale of the war because I had been the face of America on Al Jazeera during the invasion. And Al Jazeera was the only network in the world that I could actually just go across town in Doha to their network and do the interviews.
By the Qatar government?
Well, they're funded by the Qatar government the same way that the BBC is funded by the British government.
Okay.
A matter of fact, it's exactly the same way because their roots go back to BBC Arabic. So they have the exact same charter set up where there's an editorial board that exists in between the networks and the government. But, the point is Central Command headquarters are in Doha, Qatar. So is Al Jazeera headquarters. So I was able to go across town and do the interviews in their newsroom. And I became the only person in the world to be inside the Pentagon, the Bush administration, and Al Jazeera at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And what I thought I knew about Al Jazeera was just wrong. They had never shown a beheading, an actual beheading. They'd never shown one. They never would. It was in their code of ethics. They showed Al-Qaeda tapes, but Al-Qaeda actually called them pro-Western and pro-Zionist, and they called for attacks against them. All these things I thought I knew about it didn't add up. But what I did start to see by living in the region there was how powerful they were. Everyone was watching Al Jazeera. Everyone was talking about it. It was the engine that was driving the debate. And the American government had this attitude about it where we're not going to deal with them, we're not going to talk to them. And that kind of hubris and unbelievable misunderstanding based on misinformation was really dangerous for America's relationship with the rest of the world. Now, while I realized that, I was just a junior officer, and who would listen to me? So I ended up coming back frustrated as much, if not more, about that than I was the sale of the war. but who's going to listen to me? Well, it was 8 months later that someone released a film at the Sundance Film Festival without even telling me that they'd included me in this documentary film, and it was called Control Room.
Right.
I found out completely by surprise that a film about me had been released at Sundance. Someone who saw it in the audience had a friend in the Marines, got them to look up my number, called me in L.A., and left this message saying that they'd seen me in the movie and wanted to say thanks, and had no idea what they were talking about. The Pentagon was uncomfortable with me being in a movie about something so controversial. So when all the media had called to interview me about that, the Pentagon essentially said, no comment, he's not going to talk about it.
Hey, Josh, I got a break here. Do you mind holding?
No, I don't mind.
All right, well, I want to continue this on the other side because I got some more questions. I want to hear about how you ended up with Al Jazeera. I also want to ask you about your perspective on this recent trip by Ken Pollack and Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institute and the revelation that they were basically just sent around by the Pentagon to come back and write this editorial suggesting that the surge is going well. Just take your take on that.
Sure.
We've got to take a break. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. I'm talking to Josh Rushing. He's the author of Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. We'll be right back. Back, Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova Am Radio, streaming live at NovaAmRadio.com. I'm talking to Josh Rushing. He's the author of Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. He was a media liaison for the Marines during the initial invasion of Iraq, working out of CENTCOM as a spokesperson for the Central Command. He became disillusioned both with his job of actually selling the justification of the war and also with the fact that Al Jazeera, which was the main conduit to the Arab world, was being completely ignored as an opportunity by the U.S. military. And, Josh, you were telling me that when you came back 8 months later, you found out that you had actually been, edited into or edited towards, I guess, in the documentary The Control Room, which was about Al Jazeera. And so you were contacted. You found out after the movie premiered at Sundance. So what happened then?
Well, the Pentagon was uncomfortable with my role in this movie that ended up getting national distribution in theaters. So they had said no comment to all the reporters who had called to interview me about it. A lot of the coverage about me had been in the calendar section or entertainment section of newspapers and magazines. But when they said no comment, it ended up on the front page of L.A. Times and the editorial page of the L.A. Times and also in the New York Times. And what I realized was that issue that I had the year before with the way that we were dealing with Al Jazeera and how dangerous that was for America, but who will listen? I was just a junior officer. I now had a platform. I had a megaphone. I had the American media that wanted to talk to me about this Al Jazeera thing because of the movie Control Room. So I resigned my commission from the Marine Corps, turned in my uniform, and I went out on all the media to say, look, you've got to understand this Al Jazeera thing for what it is and why it's so important to us. And I was doing that for several months when a guy called me up and said he was with the BBC. He was leaving the BBC to start an English Al Jazeera, and he had seen the movie Control Room, and he thought I may be pretty good on air, and he gave me a shot of a lifetime to come and have a screen test, possibly host a show, and next thing you know, I'm the face of Al Jazeera in America.
So you're working for the Al Jazeera broadcast in America. It's only on a few stations here. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're in 100 million homes overseas. We just launched in November. Which makes us the largest launch of a network and the fastest-growing network in the world. We haven't moved into the American market much. We're in Toledo, Ohio, Burlington, Vermont. Oddly enough, the Pentagon gets us on Channel 36. But I think you'll see a lot of growth here in the next couple of years.
And so what is it exactly you do for them? Do you do reporting in the United States, but you also went over to Iraq too, didn't you?
I do military reporting for them. So most of what I do are 30-minute standalone specials. They're my own specials. They all have a military hook in some way or another. So I did go back to Iraq, and I embedded there and came back with a 30-minute special about embedding with the Iraqi infantry, which you don't see much in the Western press. I've also been down to South America recently. I'm writing a script, literally, just before this interview, I was writing a script about a show called Shadow War, where I went out with Colombian jungle commandos, finding cocaine labs in the Amazon and blowing them up. And it's all in American helicopters, American weapons, American money. I was just in Moscow 2 weeks ago interviewing Kalashnikov, the inventor of the AK-47. And I'm doing a special about that. Kills 250,000 people a year, and we worry about weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
So I do all these kind of specials. And then I'm also their military analyst. So I go on two or three times a week and talk about the military situation in Iraq, what's happening over there, and the way I see it.
What is your sense of what's happening with the surge?
Well, the hard part right now is even if the surge was succeeding, even if they were providing more stability, that's really not the end point of the surge. What they're supposed to do is provide stability so the Iraqi government can make progress against the 18 benchmarks that the U.S. government has set for it. Well, if anyone's paying attention right now, the Iraqi government went on vacation a few days ago, or longer than that, almost 2 weeks ago. They're taking the entire month of August off. So it seems to me that everything the U.S. military is doing right now is really kind of in vain, because there's no way the Iraqi government's making any progress while they're not there. And then they come back just 2 weeks before the report to Congress is due on September 15th by Petraeus and Crocker. So, to me, I think the military right now is really stuck between the hammer of Washington and the anvil of Baghdad politics. They're in a no-win situation no matter what they do. And I'm about to head over there again in a couple of weeks.
And so it's almost irrelevant at this point as to whether or not the game of whack-a-mole they have to play over there is successful for any short period of time, because the overall strategy is to provide the opportunity for this political reconciliation, which doesn't seem to be happening at all.
That's exactly my point. That's exactly my point. It doesn't matter what the military does. The political reconciliation is beyond the military's reach, and that's not happening at all. The government is literally falling apart.
Let me ask you this. Last week, there was an op-ed written by Ken Pollack and Michael Hanlon. He's from the Brookings Institute. And this was touted. They supposedly came back and said that they were optimistic as to what the military was doing over there. And we're, of course, displayed in the media as being war critics, when, in fact, Ken Pollack actually wrote a book suggesting that we do attack Iraq.
Certainly, but, certainly. O'Hanlon, he was a critic of the way they did it. If you read O'Hanlon's older pieces, he was more along the Shinseki line, where he thought it's going to take a bigger force, that there was going to be an insurgency they should be prepared for. So he was definitely a critic of the way they did it, but not a critic of the idea of invading. And he did believe that Saddam had WMD, which he now admits he was wrong on.
Now, it's just come out in an interview he did with Glenn Greenwald that O'Hanlon was basically, every single place he was taken to by the Pentagon, or essentially the military in Iraq. Did you ever get involved in something like that? And give me your perspective. I mean, is this a fairly common practice where they see an opportunity, the Pentagon sees an opportunity to get the message out there in some way, and so they basically take these guys around and make sure they see what the military wants them to see?
Oh, certainly. I've been involved in that on both sides of the fence now. As a reporter in Iraq, essentially it's the only way that you can get around is with the U.S. military. Iraq is far too dangerous for reporters to wander around without the military, unfortunately. That's why if you watch, you don't see much reporting from outside the Western lines. The fact that I eventually worked my way into getting embedded with the Iraqi military, which is still, you know, within the Western lines, as it's allied with the U.S., but even that was kind of startling reporting. You just don't see much of it, and that's because of the way the situation is in Iraq. On the military side, if they are making progress, the idea of taking around a couple of reporters and showing them the progress they're making, I don't think is that absurd of a notion. I think the reason people are offended by the way this O'Hanlon piece has come off is that in the New York Times commentary, they really presented themselves as war critics who now kind of see the light. And then it was taken around and given the full media tour under that kind of title. When the truth is, if you read their article, it's not that different than what I'm saying to you. What I have already said to you is that even if they're making progress, the military, and they might be making progress, it doesn't matter because the Iraqi government is nowhere to be found. And that's essentially the note that their op-ed piece ended on, was that in the end, it may not matter much. Now, that could be twisted and used to start shifting the blame to the Iraqi government. But as I've been over on the ground there, that seems to be the case to me as well.
All right. Well, Josh, when do you get back from your next trip from Iraq?
I think I'll be back probably around September 10th or something. I did a report. When Bush announced the surge, I was at Fort Stewart, believe it or not, Al Jazeera, with a satellite truck covering 3rd ID, 3rd Infantry Division, deploying their 1st Brigade for the third time in 5 years.
Wow.
And I spent a lot of time with the families. I had no idea what that really meant in terms of when family members deploy for 3 years out of five every other year, essentially it creates kind of a baby wave. So by that second time they come home, the wives are all getting pregnant because this is the only time they can get pregnant. So now when they're being deployed a year later, it's a bunch of, like 9-month pregnant wives or wives holding very young babies, seeing them off. And I'm going to do a follow-up with those same guys and those same families. So I'm
all
going
right,
to
Josh,
talk to find
well,
the guys.
We got to make sure that we talk. We got to go now, but I appreciate it. Josh Rushing, author of Mission Al Jazeera. We got to take a break. We'll take your calls, 800-989-1480. Back, Sam Cedar filling in for the great Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. That was Josh Rushing, an amazing story. A guy got so disillusioned with his job of having to be a shill. And the idea of political operatives sticking their hands in places they shouldn't be, of course, is par for the course with the Bush administration. This story I don't even know how to respond to this. Justice Department said on Saturday that Alberto Gonzalez is spending some time in Iraq. He arrived in Baghdad on Saturday to meet with department officials who have been there to help fashion the country's legal system. I guess apparently he's being sent over there to make sure that they are destroying the infrastructure of the justice system in Iraq as well as they have done it here in this country. Numbers 800-989-1480. Let's go to Joel in Berkeley, California. Welcome to the program, Joel.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks
I'm doing
for
great.
Filling in for Mike.
Oh,
and for
pleasure.
Rachel, I heard you on Rachel Maddow's show earlier today.
Yeah, so I'm working overtime.
Yeah, you're the king of radio today. Hey, I'm a great interview too that you just finished up. Really fantastic. I'm actually calling about a couple things you said on Rachel's show, and I wanted to take issue with them a little bit. The first was you had said that you thought that the Republicans had branded themselves as the rule of law party, and I wanted to draw a distinction between that. I don't think they've are, of course, the rule of law party, or they ever were. What they've claimed to be is a law and order party, and that's a really different thing. The rule of law is about equal justice for all and about laws, not people carrying the day. Law and order is about authority, power, and control, and that's pretty much what the Republican Party's been all about for certainly the last 20 years or so.
Well, yeah. I mean, I agree with you to the extent that, I mean, you know, Nixon started this with the law and order thing, which basically was code for keep the people from expressing themselves.
It's code for fascism, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But you also got to remember, during the Clinton years, that's all we heard from the Republicans.
Yeah.
I mean, that's their basis of why they impeached the president, was rule of law, rule of law. We have to be, if Bill Clinton lied in a deposition about having sex with somebody, then he's got to be impeached, because the rule of law has to stand for everybody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, that's what, you know, I'm not convinced, quite frankly, that that wasn't, you know, what led to a lot of the problems that we had subsequently, you know, in terms of fighting terror and whatnot. I mean, Bill Clinton was not in a position to fire the stiff he had at the FBI because, of course, there was all this suspicion that there was some grand conspiracy all ultimately boiled down to when he got serviced, if you will. But
yep.
I appreciate the call, Joel. Let's go to Nora in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program, Nora.
Oh, hi. I'm calling in because I'm so disturbed when I look at this. I'm just thinking, is it just me, or does this entire coal scenario look like something from Oliver Twist or the Dark Ages? Think about it. Humans under the ground chipping out this black stuff that they then take out and burn to spew out mercury and carbon dioxide. How is that for the 21st century?
Well, I mean, if you're saying that we should have come up with a better source of energy at this point, I think there's probably $2 trillion invested in Iraq that could have gone a long way to do to achieve some type of alternative energy. But I agree with you. It's just it's a damn shame. Let's go to Lou in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Welcome to the program, Lou.
How you doing, Sam?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Oh, okay. I'm just going to change the subject just for a second, but I had something that I thought was sort of humorous and ironic. This Iowa straw poll.
Yeah, it was actually both humorous and ironic.
Yeah, well, there's something even more so. You got the two top contenders. You got old Mutt Romney and then Chuckleby that both have sons. There's seven sons between them. Both of those two are both chicken hawks. And their seven sons evidently are following their daddies because not a one of the seven are in the military.
Now, wait a second, Lou. Now, wait a second.
Okay.
I got to be fair here, okay? Now, Mitt Romney has already said that his sons are serving America just as much as those in the military by going around in a Winnebago and helping him win the Iowa straw poll.
Oh, golly.
All right.
I didn't know that. I feel bad now even thinking that they're chicken hawks.
Exactly, Lou. I mean, come on.
I feel bad. Yeah, and
you got the guys, they're hanging out in a Winnebago. Maybe it's hot. Maybe there's no air conditioning in there.
Well,
maybe they only get AM radio. Who knows?
They've been known to break down, those air conditioners.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, and then you got Chuckleby's two boys that I know they're pretty busy down here in Little Rock. So, well, I'm sorry I bothered you. I really do. I feel bad now. You made me feel bad.
Yeah, there you go, Lou. Well, you say a couple of penitences, but I appreciate
the phone call. I will. I'll say a couple of Hail Marys or something like that. Thanks
all right.
A lot.
Thanks, Lou. All right. Number's 800-989-1480. Now, to be fair, Mitt Romney, of course, clarified a statement by basically saying I was 100% wrong when I said that, which is completely par for the course with multiple choice Mitt. You know, I think there's some type of decoder ring you can get where if it's a Tuesday, what he said on Tuesday, you can predict that he's going to say the absolute opposite thing on Thursday. We come back, we'll talk about another stiff who didn't have time to make it to the Iowa straw poll. Of course, I'm talking about Rudy Giuliani. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. 800-989-1480. We'll be right back.
I need a hole in my head. Give up my whole day's wages to get this hole in the wall. I call a holster that is empty, just a gun to the head. I am a holy roller, I'm playing Russian roulette.
We are back, Sam Cedar filling in for the great Mike Malloy. Unbelievable, the hubris of these Republicans. They come to believe their own bullcrap. I don't know how else to say that appropriately. It's just astonishing. Mitt Romney going out there, my five sons, they're serving this country as well as anybody in Iraq and as well as anybody in the military, because they're driving around Iowa and in the Mittmobile, and they, I wonder if they're cleaning dog poop off it. Did you hear that? You may have heard this story already, but here's Mitt Romney defending it. The only time Chris Wallace, I think, has ever challenged a single Republican show, and of course it's over a dog. But Mitt Romney went on a family trip. His five sons and his wife. And they brought the family dog, and they put him in one of those plastic dog travel kennels, and they strapped it to the roof of a car on a 12-hour trip. Now, what you don't hear in this conversation is the way it was, I guess, discovered that the dog had a little problem with this. Was that he pooped himself, and it was dripping down the car. But here's Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday talking to Mitt Romney. Now, presumably, you know, his sons at the time, they were riding the back of the station wagon. I guess that was just about basically the same as being in a tank in Iraq or something. I mean, according to Mitt Romney. All right, here's number six. This is Chris Wallace grilling Mitt Romney about this dog story.
Back in 1983, you took your Irish setter, Seamus, on a 12-hour road trip tied to the roof of your car.
Let me finish.
Okay. In a kennel, inside a kennel.
Yes.
Okay. I have a yellow lab named Winston. I would no sooner put him in a kennel on the roof of my car than I would one of my children. Question. What were you thinking?
This is a completely airtight kennel.
He couldn't breathe!
On the top of our car.
He couldn't breathe!
He climbed up there regularly, enjoyed himself. He was in a kennel at home a great deal of time as well. We loved the dog. It was where he was comfortable. We had five kids inside the car. My guess is he liked it a lot better in his kennel than he would have liked it inside.
Well, I got to tell you, Massachusetts law and dog lovers, and I'm one of them, take this seriously. Massachusetts law prohibits carrying an animal on top of a car, even in a kennel, as cruel and inhuman.
I wasn't familiar with that in terms of Massachusetts law. Love my dog. We've had a lot of dogs over the years. Love them. Seamus, as his name is, climbed up there all by himself. Enjoyed his ride.
He climbed up into the hermetically sealed kennel.
Carrier. It was a good ride. And all I can tell you is I didn't know that there was any problem with that in terms of the law. And he was a good friend of the family. We love our pets.
And, of course, he doesn't mention the fact that, and first of all, if you have dogs, you know that if they're kennel trained, they don't take craps in them unless there's something severely wrong. And it could have been flying down the highway at 50 miles an hour. Now, according to Mitt Romney, it's airtight. Apparently, he's got one of those special Irish setters that doesn't need oxygen to function. And, of course, it's not just Mitt Romney. I mean, you know, let's listen to Rudy Giuliani. Now, you know that there are hundreds of 9/11 workers who are now desperately ill. Michael Moore had a couple of them in his movie in Sicko. From inhaling all the crap that was down there, Rudy Giuliani did nothing to protect these workers. He and Christy Todd Whitman, the head of the EPA at the time, lied to the American public and lied to the people working at Ground Zero as to the air quality. These people are desperately ill now with all sorts of respiratory illnesses. Now, presumably, Rudy Giuliani didn't get it because he's a Superman. Because, and you may not have known this, But Rudy Giuliani was there more than any of those rescue workers. This is A.
Rudy Giuliani is firing back this morning against criticism by relatives of 9/11 victims. They say the former New York City mayor mismanaged the aftermath of the attacks. But Giuliani says he was with rescuers at the debris pile and even spent more time than some workers.
This is not a mayor or a governor or a president who was sitting in an ivory tower. I was at Ground Zero as often, if not more than most of the workers. I was there working with them. I was there guiding things. I was there bringing people there. But I was exposed to exactly the same things they were exposed to. So in that sense, I'm one of them.
The head of the police department's detectives union says Giuliani's record can't compare to those who spent a year sifting through the toxic debris.
Oh, he's not sitting in an ivory tower, though. Let's go to Jeff in Hollywood, Florida. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
First off, you guys should tip your hats. You helped us get the 06, okay? All your crew, the radio, Air America, Nova M, everybody. Thanks.
Well, I mean, I think everybody, you know, everybody who listens to these programs, everybody who is involved in online activism and online activism and offline activism. I mean, this was a huge victory, but it's basically just one small step. There's a lot more work to be done, and this FISA legislation is a perfect example of it.
Well, it opened the door to a nightmare, actually. Yeah. But I wanted to I saw the Kenny Bunk boys up in Kenny Punk, Maine,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking at Rove resigning. And I'm looking at Jeb just kind of, I'm in Florida, you know. So he just kind of eased out like a mist, you know, and then walks this other guy, Chris. And
right.
I would keep my eye on Jeb. I'd keep my eye on Rove and working behind the scenes with this guy.
Listen, there's only one way that Jeb Bush is ever going to have a political future, and that's if he changes his last name.
I don't know. I don't know, Sam. They're going to work the system as far as they can, I think, before he starts his little farm and his EO. You know?
Well, Jeff, listen. Listen, I agree with you, but you know, too many people give too much credit to this Karl Rove. He did a great job of destroying the functioning apparatus of government. But I mean, look at what his political track record has been.
This guy is destroyed. He's a criminal, man. He'll go pull the rug out from underneath.
Well, of course, but I don't think he has the ability to get Jeb Bush elected. The worst thing ever to happen is another Bush who affiliates himself with Karl Rove. Karl Rove is done. He will go now off into the right wing, safety net. He'll get some job at he'll be getting cash just like Scooter Libby did.
You're absolutely correct.
Some think tank. He'll write a book that he attempts to say that. You know, we did great things in the White House, and George Bush was fantastic, and I was amazing, and he will write it all off the top of his head, because, of course, he doesn't keep any diaries that can be subpoenaed. And
I just don't see these guys leaving that gently. I see them working the system until they absolutely can't, and then they're going to drop something on us.
Well, you may be right about that, Jeff. I appreciate the phone call. I mean, who knows what these guys have in store, but listen to the media just gush. Look at this guy here. I mean, he gamed the system, yes, but he also destroyed things like the integrity of our Department of Justice. The guy was having partisan meetings with our foreign diplomats. How you can help out the Republicans win in 06 and in 08. I mean, this FISA law. He did this FISA thing was... There is no policy determination. There is no decision that is made by this White House, certainly not under Karl Rove, that has anything to do with any type of policy agenda. Every decision is made based upon the perceived politics of it. And fortunately for us, his whole theory about this 51% polarized the country has completely just come back to bite him. Republican Party is in complete disarray now. Let's play this montage of the corporate morons in the media gushing over Karl Rove. This is B.
I think Robe is really smart. If you've ever talked to him, he's almost got almost like a blinders on. He looks right in the eye, and he talks faster than I do, really fast, right in your face, totally intent on you. And it's really like talking to a fire hydrant.
Paul Rove loves politics. He's awfully smart.
He's not only the mastermind behind everything, he's the president's senior advisor, a mastermind behind the two successful runs for the White House.
Political genius. Bush's brain, some of the labels put on Karl Rove.
Brilliant tactician.
Boy genius, Bush's brain, the architect.
Karl is brilliant, he is funny, and he's a passionate advocate.
We should be congratulating Karl Rove for a long, successful run. This is a guy who elected a president twice, who's known as one of the most brilliant political activists of our time.
Hey, 70, do you share the same sentiments about Karl Rove this morning?
Well, I think that he is clearly a brilliant mind.
Karl Rove is a superstar. He is very insightful. He's a great friend to the president, and he's also a very broad thinker. He is one of the more intelligent people that I know. He's very quick-witted. He's got a great sense of humor, and the president will miss him. Well, there are more myths to Karl Rove than reality, but the reality is he is very smart, makes tremendous contributions. He's much broader than the political punditry that he's known for. He's extremely well-read.
But generally, where there's brains, there's Rove.
That's from Think Progress. But who cares? I mean, how is it that this much time was spent on praising this guy for being some type of genius without a single mention, of what he has done to our functioning government? You remember, this is the guy who's in charge of the rebuilding of New Orleans. Not a single mention of it. Just criminal. All right, we got to take a break. Numbers 800-989-1480. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on NovaAm Radio.
Keep track of the visions in my eyes.
Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. I didn't even have to climb up a fire escape to get in here. Pleasure to be broadcasting on NovaAm Radio. Check it out, NovaAmRadio.com. Let's go to the phones. Larry in Berkeley, California. Welcome to the program, Larry.
Hey, Sam. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Hey, I had a question about Karl Rove. He said he's leaving to spend more time with his family.
Ha!
Does he have a family?
He does.
Is he married?
Yes.
Does he have kids?
He is married. I think he actually has a kid, which
kidding.
Is astonishing.
He's the spawn of Satan. I thought that was his family.
I mean, one must wonder whether or not he thinks that he can live in some type of hermetically sealed bubble. But, man, I'll tell you something. It would be difficult being his... his child.
What an embarrassment. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, one cannot impose the sins of the father on the child, but you have to feel bad for that kid. He is going to have to grow up and come to understand his father's place in American history, and I can assure you it is going to be an ugly one.
Nice.
But I appreciate the call, Larry.
Thanks.
And, you know, he's not leaving to spend time with his family. Give me a break. Countdown to the divorce. He is leaving because the ship is sinking, and he wants to get off really fast. Let's go to Paul in Martinez, California. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Hello.
Paul.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay, and you?
I'm doing great.
I just want to say my wife and I are big fans.
I'm glad to hear that.
And I actually have a question for you.
That's why I assumed you called.
All right. I saw a published report a few days ago about Marcus Miletus.
Yes, he is the proprietor of the Daily Kos. And in fact, I got some clips of him really putting a smackdown on Harold Ford. We'll play those later in the program. He really handed it to the DLC this weekend on Meet the Press.
Oh, really? Because these reports said that he had applied at one time to be a CIA agent.
Yeah, I believe that actually came from an interview from him.
Yeah, he's quite upfront about, you know, yeah, he applied to be a CIA agent, and I guess that he went through the whole process.
Right.
And I guess he changed his mind because he didn't like the prospect of sending, you know, 6 years in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think so. I think he also got a job, maybe, or he started working on the Dean campaign. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, right. But anyway, I was just wondering, you know, what your commentary is on that, because I know that in the past, you know, you'd have him on your show every week and all
that.
Oh,
yeah.
This particular article that I read, you know, went through the whole litany of the CIA's kind of crimes against humanity, and, you know, this particular author kind of juxtaposing what the CIA, you know, what they've done, and Marcus Miletus, you know, saying that he was okay with that, and, you know, so I was wondering what you'd have to say about that.
I don't know that. I'll let you go, and I'll answer off the air there. I I don't think you can judge Marcos based upon what the CIA did. I mean, it was something that he was interested in. He pursued it. He never did it. I don't think every single person who works at the CIA is an evil person. I just don't think that's the case. I mean, the guy was a Reagan Democrat. I mean, that to me is more disturbing. But he's young. He didn't have the advantage of the wisdom that comes with age. Marcus Miletus, as far as I'm concerned, and he would be the first one to deny this, but I believe that he has radically changed the political landscape for everyone. Maybe there would have been a different Marcos. If there was no Marcus Miletus, maybe it would be Mary Miletus. I don't know that he has a sister, but my point is that anybody, you know, if somebody else had set up that site, but you got 500,000 plus people every day going to that site, thousands of people posting and writing diaries and really affecting our politics in this country. I mean, granted, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's very impressive stuff. And he really, really smacked down Harold Ford, who, I mean, I've never been a fan of Harold Ford's. I haven't followed his career that closely, but he was basically the Joe Lieberman in the House for the Democrats. And he is now the head of the DLC, which is the sort of the bedrock of the corporatist wing of the Democratic Party. And fortunately, the DLC is, how can I put this, in remission? And at the end of this interview, Ford was just, talk about desperate, man. He pulled something, a total Lieberman. We'll play that clip for you on the other side. We're going to be talking to my buddy Brett Netson from Built to Spill. Get a sense of what's going on out in the country there. What the kids are up to. Sam Cedar filling in for the great Mike Malloy on the equally fantastic Nova M Radio Network. The more the merrier, folks. The more progressive talk we can get in this country, the better. We'll take some calls, 800-989-1480. Cedar in for Malloy. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program a huge Mike Malloy fan. Brett Netson from the band Built to Spill. Brett, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Now, you're in Boise now?
I'm in Boise, Idaho. That's right.
And are you guys on tour, or is it ended?
We're on a break now. We just did the – I saw you in New York. We did the East Coast and all that, you know.
Right.
And then we're going to go out and do the West Coast in Canada and then, you know, Australia in the wintertime.
Now, you guys you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about what you guys do is you're not afraid to get up there and get political overtly, and also very supportive of progressive radio in general, and and, you know, tell me from your perspective, you've been touring for what, for how many years now?
Like 15 years or something.
Are you noticing a difference in most of the people who come out to see you are basically college age up until about 30, 35, would you say?
Yeah, they are, you know, and they keep staying college age, too, as I get older. It's really strange. I don't know what that's all about. But, yeah, you know, part of it's kind of where we come from. We came from sort of the punk rock scene, you know, is what was what it had turned into, say, you know, late 80s. You know, we started playing around town and then touring and all this stuff. And that was, you know, absolutely political, you know, in a sense, you know, a lifestyle. Your lifestyle was your political statement, you know, in those days. We started touring, you know, like Henry Rollins, get in the van, you know.
Right.
You get in the van and you go on tour and you just do the best you can. And you sleep outside and all this stuff. And maybe you got enough money for a Motel 6. And back in those days, there was a pretty tight-knit community, you see, everywhere around the country. You know, that was the kind of thing. You would play your show to, like, your 50 to 100 people. And then, you know, there was always somebody there to let you stay at their house or something like that. You
right.
know, it was that kind of a scene. And this was not on TV, you know. And so I've noticed over the years a very, very pronounced difference as things go on, most notably with the Telecommunications Act, you know, which I didn't notice happened until after it happened. I mean, I started noticing commercial alternative radio stations, you know. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, those little clubs can't afford to buy ads in the weeklies anymore around
right.
the country. You know, the weeklies, they're all the same. It's the same weekly everywhere in the whole country. You know, you figure that one out, too. It's like, oh, wow, you know, these are kind of
same company
things.
Just gets in the business of the alt weeklies and basically just pumps out the same formula in every city.
Yeah, they got more money. It's the old infrastructure, you know, and it happens. You know, I guess I'm here to explain that it's happening there, too.
Right.
It's not just happening in politics. It's happening everywhere, you know, everywhere. And, you know, that was a Bill Clinton move right there, the Telecommunications Act. Because I started noticing all these stations, and they're like, these are not bands I have ever heard of, you know, with all the hundreds of fanzines and locally produced little magazines and all these, you know, independent, you know, do-it-yourself kinds of things. I never heard of these bands. All of a sudden, all these bands come in, and, you know, along with the Nirvana, this became like the post-Nirvana co-opt of our whole independent music scene. Just swept it right up. Ba-boom. They bought it all. Just like, you know, Clear Channel just did it. Just like, you know, everybody else kinds of, it always ends up happening, things like
that. Well, I mean, that was one of the things, and that's, you know, one of the problems that we have across the board is that once you start making this, once you allow for this type of corporate ownership of all these outlets, it becomes the most sensible business model for them to make one product and just pump it everywhere.
They engineer this stuff and they learn how to lowball it. Down lower and lower to the point where it's just crappy enough where people will still buy it, you know? And then, boom, they got it. And then they can just crank that stuff out.
Have you know? No, have, you, Tell me, have you noticed like a difference with your audience, though? I mean, has the nature of youth? I mean, there's all these, polls coming out now that are suggesting that during the Reagan years, when I think you and I probably were both in college or sometime around that time, there was supposedly that time our generation, the 18 to 30 year olds or something, were really indoctrinated with this this sort of virulent strain of conservatism, where this notion that government is bad, government's the problem.
Absolutely.
And it seems to the pendulum seems to have swung back the other way. I mean, is that something you picked up on?
That's a very good point, Sam. And you know, me also, what I am is I've become, a progressive media junkie, and I think that a lot of people have, because to me, this is more exciting. This is exciting like punk rock was exciting when I first discovered it. When I heard Jello Biafra going off about the things he was talking about, and Henry Rollins, and even Adam Hoffman and all this stuff. It was, when I was a teenager, I was just obsessed with these things. And then, okay, so you're right. So then, I don't know where it came from, and I guess, maybe Reagan and all this sort of thing. It became fashionable to distrust government, and they engineered that, is what it seems like to me. Like, they can engineer that to where, okay, everybody thinks government's bad. Everybody's bad. They're all bad.
Well, that's exactly, if you ever spend any time listening to Rush Limbaugh, that is exactly everything that he is talking about. Do not trust the government. The government will not help you. If you're stranded in New Orleans, it's your fault. You can never rely on the government. And of course, this is why we have governments. This is why we form societies.
I know.
Industry is going to go and rebuild that city? It's not happening.
Right. And so maybe the beauty of the situation now, to look on the bright side or whatever, or out of any tragedy, there's, some kind of a redeeming something to it. Maybe the pendulum has swung back where people are looking back like I am. I wrote all that stuff off. I have anarchy symbols on my leather jacket and all these sorts of things. Guess what anarchy actually looks like? It looks like Bush and all those guys.
Exactly.
Whoa. Okay. All right. Well, I guess that means that the rich and powerful have control. But so I'm looking back. You listen to Tom Hartman. You read some books, and you start thinking man. I think about my grandparents, and their kind of union jobs. And my uncle had just died recently, and he was all crippled on the couch. But he had a union job, and he had health care and all these things. And I'm wow. Maybe you go to Europe a few times, and you got community centers and all these sorts of things. And you're just wait a minute. In hearing Marcos talking last night on your show, that was really amazing what he was saying.
Marcos Melitzis.
Yeah, the way he said, you had the clips, but he said, yeah, I'm a liberal. But what we're doing is more than that. This is not about my agenda. And that's the way I feel. This is not about, I feel angry and scared, and I feel like I want to do something. But not on my behalf. I could probably run my game. I'm a pretty resourceful person, by nature, but I'm scared for everybody, This is beyond my agenda. This is maybe we as a country could re-examine what it was we were about, And I started thinking, the 4th of July comes now. Now I actually think about that. The Declaration of Independence. That was about overthrowing a corporation,
Exactly.
I'm whoa. And you see a bunch of jackasses out in their, brand new trucks lighting crap on fire. Which I don't get me wrong. I love to light things on fire, but it's okay, you guys are going to Walmart and buying all of this stuff and financing jet skis and all this crap, and you take kids out for 4th of July, It's no, that's not what this is about, these sorts of things. And I'm grateful to you and to Mike Malloy. I sit and listen to Mike almost every night, because
he's keeping a large portion of this country sane, I think.
Well, sure. He has emotional content to what he's doing. And he speaks to you like you're a friend, you know, like it's an intimate thing. And he talks about culture and stuff too, and that's something else that you'd brought up. You said you were kind of interested in expanding, you know, with this progressive talk radio, you know, talk about some other things, some culture, the music and stuff. And, you know, the music reflects what's going on, and the corporatization of music, you know, there it is. The kid, I mean, it's, look, out here there's a lot of strip malls. This is a small town, relatively, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you got your Walmarts and your strip malls, and they're going in like a cancer, you know, and it's disgusting. And every little bit of mojo and cool oldness and history this place has is being rewritten by those people, by those huge corporations with their huge infrastructure, you know, and the little people have no choice but to take the money.
Exactly.
When they want to set up shop, you know, and oh, gosh, what was my point?
Well, I think the point is, and Brett, we got to go because the music's starting soon, but I appreciate you joining me. But the point is, keep it local. I mean,
I think, you know, the
bottom line is it's going to come down to the only way to deal with these things is going to be you make a choice as to where you spend your dollar. And, you know, you got to spend it in a place where it's going to help what's happening locally.
And have a little self-respect and have something to be proud of, you know.
Exactly. Well, listen, I really appreciate what you guys are doing. And, you know, you guys are going around, and I know you guys are contributing to things like Democracy Now! And helping progressive radio when you can. And you certainly it was gave me an opportunity to speak to a bunch of kids in Brooklyn. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you for doing that, by the way.
Well, it was my pleasure. Brett Natson from Built to Spill. Thanks for joining us, Brett.
Thank you.
It was awesome. All right, we got to take a break. We'll come back. I'll take some calls, 800-989-1480. I know a bunch of you have been holding for a long time. We'll get to those calls. We'll talk about Rudy Giuliani, an amazing piece in the Village Voice. One of the you're not going to believe this. We'll be right back. Sam Cedar in from Mike Malloy on Novam Radio. Rudy Giuliani, great piece in the Village Voice by Wayne Barrett. He wrote that book, The Grand Illusion, which is about Giuliani's fake credentials as some type of 9/11 hero. A lot of people, you know, this story gets bandied around. New angle to this story, unbelievable. You've all heard, I hope, at this point, why Rudy Giuliani was walking towards the Twin Towers the day that they were hit. Because following the 93 terrorist attack on the Twin Towers, Rudy Giuliani, for some unknown reason, insisted that, A, the Central Command Center, where the cops and the firemen and city officials gather in the event of a terrorist attack or any other type of emergency, be situated within walking distance of the city hall. Now, you could have easily gone to Brooklyn. Would have been a walk across the Brooklyn Bridge. But he ended up putting it in Tower 7 of the World Trade Center. This is the same complex that had been attacked by terrorists in 93. And part of this story on the five big lies of Rudy Giuliani. Lie number three, Giuliani doesn't deserve the blame for putting the city's emergency command center in the World Trade Center. He writes, the World Trade Center 7 site was the brainchild of Bill Diamond, a prominent Manhattan Republican that Giuliani had installed at the city agency handling rentals. His office, Diamond's office, had selected the same building to house nine federal agencies. Diamond's GOP-wired broker steered Hauer to the building. This is Jerry Hauer. He's the Office of Emergency Management Chief. The building was owned by this guy, Silverstein, who was a major donor to Giuliani and fundraiser. Apparently, floor 23 had never been rented. This was the floor that Rudy Giuliani decided was going to be his bunker in the sky with tons of diesel fuel unprotected just floors below. The mayor was so personally focused on the siting and construction of the bunker that the city administrator oversaw it, testified in a subsequent lawsuit that, quote, very senior officials, specifically including Giuliani, were involved, which he said was a major difference between this and other projects. Giuliani's office had a humidor for cigars and mementos from City Hall, including a fire horn, police hats, and fire hats, as well as monogrammed towels in his bathroom. Now, remember, the reason why so many firemen died when those towers came down was because they had no way of communicating with the cops, because they could not be in the same room in this command center. His suite was bulletproofed, and he visited it often, even on weekends, bringing his then-girlfriend Judy Nathan there long before the relationship surfaced. He had his own elevator. He had an adulterous affair in the command center and wanted it within walking distance of City Hall so he could maintain this affair behind his wife's back. And it ended up causing the deaths of possibly over 100 firemen. Unbelievable. Now we know where Bernie Kerik got the idea to use that apartment that was donated for 9/11 rescue workers to carry on his own tryst with, I think her name was Judith Regan. Unbelievable, these guys. All right, we'll take phone calls when we get back, I promise. 800-989-1480. And if we take conservative calls, folks, we will take your call if you're a conservative, I promise. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy, 800-989-1480. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. Your faith-based dollars at work, folks. Director of a Christian boot camp and employee were arrested on Friday for dragging a 15-year-old girl behind a van after she fell behind the group during the morning run. Charles Eugene Flowers and Stephanie Bassett of Love Demonstrated Ministries, a 32-day boot camp, were arrested on aggravated assault charges for the alleged June 12th incident. Apparently, this girl was not keeping pace, so they tied her to the back of a van and made her jog faster. I don't know how many tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars this specific outfit got, but it did get some money as part of the faith-based initiative. I don't know, really. I don't know what else to say about that. Kurt! From Worcester, Massachusetts. You've been hanging on for a long time, buddy. Thanks for your patience.
Yeah, hi, Sam. I want to mention a couple of Democrats that are challenging incumbents in the primaries, starting with Melissa Bean being challenged by Randy Schuer, a woman, Randy, S-C-H-E-U-R-E-R.
Uh-huh.
Her website, freethedemocrats.com, challenging this Lieberman address in the House of Representatives of Illinois. And here in Massachusetts, our Senator John Kerry is being challenged by an anti-war Democrat in the primary, Ed O'Reilly. EdO'Reilly.com, O-R-E-I-L-L-Y.com, so... if you could check these guys out.
Will do, Kurt.
Yeah, try to get rid of Melissa Bean. Oh, man, oh, I want her gone.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, you know, you got a good point, and I appreciate it. You got two, you know, that is the next step. It's to get better Democrats, more and better Democrats. It's not going to happen overnight, and, you know, you still, well, I guess we got lost them. But this is what is called for at this point. Don, on the road in Missouri. Welcome to the program, Don.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
Excellent. I would think that the idea, as opposed to challenging Democrats that are mediocre, is moving out Republicans that are worthless, myself.
Well, they're not mutually exclusive.
I mean,
there are times when you've got, you know, you've got Democrats in a solidly blue district, or you know, one where you know, basically a solidly blue district where you can basically upgrade, and you know, I think that's definitely a worthwhile endeavor, frankly.
All right, let's see. Did you hear the? Well, no. Quick pass on Giuliani. Up until now, I really didn't care who the Republicans put up, but with the recent news, I really hope it's Giuliani, because after the 08 election, you'll never hear Swift voting again. It will be called a Giuliani, because if he runs, the true heroes of 9/11 are gonna, you know, choose your axiom. You know, they're just gonna take him apart, it seems.
Yeah, but John, you know, there's a fundamental difference there. The Swift votes for so-called truth were liars.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. But you will see advertisements similar to the Swift vote campaign, but they will all be documented, and they will be from true heroes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's hard for me. You know, I have to say, I sort of I salivate at the notion of any of these stooges running for you know, becoming the nominee. I mean, heck, when, you know, not only could they not get nearly half the amount of people at the at this Iowa straw poll that they had the last time they had an open candidate, but a poll taken of Republicans in Iowa, Barack Obama came in third.
Yeah, I heard that.
Unbelievable.
I think that's sweet. You know, it's the Democrats to lose. You know, if we screw it up bad enough. And Karl Rove, you know, you may think he's just going to go coast off into the sunset. I'm believing he's going to be working real hard on this Soviet election.
Well,
in some capacity.
I don't know what it is yet. I don't doubt it, but he's already,
you know,
set the table.
His dream of 100-year, you know, that whatever that was called, the Project for a New American Century, of 100-year, you know, Republican majority is still in his brain. But what I called about, did you hear a piece of news today that Harry Reid's office announced that the Trump will not be making any recess appointments while Congress is gone?
Yeah, I mean, I've read a couple of things about that. There was a couple of different sort of procedural things that they were doing to prevent that, and I think part of it also had to do with a deal they made on the FISA thing, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking. Is that's exactly why they signed that FISA and ran it through. And I have to remain, you know, optimistic. I believe that this this herd of turtles that we have in there disguised as Democrats will eventually get their ducks in a row and get headed one way. And as soon as they get back from recess, Nancy Pelosi, I understand, gave over that bill to her minions and said, write me a good one, just before the break started. So I'm hoping that they'll pick that up first thing. You know, it's got a sunset clause of 6 months, but hopefully they'll pick that up right out of the gate when they get back and say, okay, let's do it this way.
Yeah, I hope you're right, Don. But I don't know that they can do that. I mean, I frankly, I just don't know. I don't know. You know, the sunset provision is a little bit fuzzy, and you know, if they try and overturn it by legislation, it's going to get vetoed. And you know, everybody was saying the same thing with the Military Commissions Act, but they haven't been able to reverse that either. And you know, so I mean, I would like to put the best face on it, Don. But the fact of the matter is, this was a failure. It was a failure. Maybe it was just a failure of they miscounted a vote, or maybe they shouldn't have believed Mike McConnell, or maybe they shouldn't have just gotten so scared. But this was a failure.
Well, the Dems, I believe everybody should call their representative, and if they're Republican, tell them they're an idiot, and if they're Democrat, just tell them, hey, you know, look at the polls. We got your back.
Yeah.
We put you there for a reason. Go ahead and do it.
I agree with you, John. I agree with you. I appreciate the call.
I truly, truly do.
I appreciate the call.
All right. Have a good evening.
You too, sir.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Jane in Corte Madera, California. Welcome to the program, Jane.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate your taking my call. I just got back from one of the most incredible movies I've seen. It's called No End in Sight, and it's a documentary about the Iraq War. It's a series of interviews with all the people who have been involved since shock and awe. And it should be mandatory viewing for everybody in this country, Democrats and, as well as Republicans. When it was over, people just sat there, just dumbfounded. Their actual interviews of everybody, Bremer and, you know, the whole gang, Rumsfeld waving his arms around and talking about when they were looting the museum, and he said, we remember that when he said, oh, you just see the same pictures, the same people coming out with vases. He said, there can't be that many vases in Iraq, laughing. And starting out from what Iraq looked like when it was just before it was bombed and what it looks like now and the people dying on the street and the blood. And the, it's all for real. This is not Hollywood. It's an actual documentary interview with all of these people who told the truth, and I highly recommend it. That's all I have to say.
Right,
called
Jane.
No End in Sight.
Yeah, I've heard of the documentary. There's been some criticism of the documentary a little bit from the left in that it doesn't really address the fundamental question of whether preemptive war was prescribed in this situation. Frankly, this was not even a preemptive war. This is a preventative war. A preemptive war is when all of a sudden you look out the Canadian border and the Canadians have amassed massive troops and they're about to attack us and you decide to attack them first. That's preemptive war. You don't hear many people talk about that preemptive doctrine anymore. What we were involved in was a preventative war. Someday this country could be a threat to us. I mean, that's when they, you know, that's the classic Western where they kill the son of the guy that you've killed because you're afraid he's going to grow up and kill you. But my understanding is that film is very powerful because it has, like the caller said, just about every person who was involved in the architecture of this disaster. The same delusion that felt that you could go in there and create this free market haven. The shock and awe was designed not just to defeat them militarily, but the theory behind it was to completely annihilate the culture so that you could start from basically year zero. I think it was Naomi Klein had a great piece in Harper's Magazine entitled Baghdad, Year Zero, about these free marketers who went in there and thought, this is fantastic. The place is leveled. We can privatize everything. Reuters has a story out yesterday just how disastrous that was. All right, we got to take a break. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. The number is 800-989-1480. Take some calls when we get back. Up into a million pieces and fly into the sun. I would not run from the blazing light. I would not run from this rain. I'd see it as an inch of misery, as an inch of worldly pain. We're back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy, Nova M Radio. Thomas calling from KPHX, Phoenix. Welcome to the program, Thomas.
Hi. Well, I sure wish they would get you back on the air full time. I'm glad that they have you on Cedar on Sundays and everything.
Appreciate it, Thomas.
Yeah. Let me collect my thoughts here. What I was going to say. Well, an earlier caller mentioned Rove possibly, you know, focusing his time now on maybe switching over to, you know, for the upcoming elections early, so he can start orchestrating the next Republican victory, hopefully in his mind. Another thing I was going to get at was about the Democrats. I feel like what you were saying with the failure, I feel like they just rolled over. I mean, it just seems so obvious. They didn't put up a fight or anything. They just rolled over and, you know, and it tells me that something's not right, that there must be a lot of Democrats on the take there, you know.
Well, I mean, look, there's a very large contingency of blue dog Democrats, and we just need to get more and better Democrats. We need to get them a stronger majority, and we need to get them more progressives. And it's not going to happen overnight. And, you know, I don't know the justifications of what these people are thinking, but Russ Feingold said it, you know, in the New York Times the other day. The one thing this White House has figured out, that the Democratic Party, you start talking about terrorism, and they will just roll over like some puppy dogs.
One other note I just want you to note is I wrote to McCain, Senator of Arizona, several years ago in the 90s when to urge him not to vote to impeach Clinton, and made the case basically for Clinton. And he wrote me back, and it was exactly verbatim in his letter. I still have a copy of his letter that he wrote me back, and also the one that I mailed him. And he points out exactly like you said over and over again, repeatedly throughout the letter, about the rule of law, rule of law, rule of law, rule of law.
Well, John McCain has shown himself to be an absolute joke. And, you know, unfortunately for all of us, his presidential aspirations have ended. I appreciate the call, Thomas.
Thank you.
Unbelievable. Yeah, he is done. McCain is done. Is he even still running anymore? Does anybody know? Did he announce that he's dropping out of the race yet? Or that was Tommy Thompson. Man, it's just so many jokers. Sheldon in Oakland, California. Welcome to the program, Sheldon.
Oh, Sam?
Sheldon.
Sam?
Sheldon.
I'm here.
Welcome.
Hi. Can I talk? You hear
Please?
Me?
Yes, of
oh,
course.
Oh, good. I want to make it short because time is running out. Listen, 70 million people stayed home in 2004. You better concentrate your energies on Mitt Romney and Fred Thompson. One of those two is going to be selected by the Republicans, and they're both dreadful. It'll make George Bush like Elsie Dinsmore. And if more people voted, you know, more people voted for American Idol. You know, Sam, most of the people in this country, I've come to the conclusion, we're going to implode from within if we're not doing it already. We are our own worst enemy. Most Americans are really stupid and greedy and corrupt. Not all of them, but at least half the country. They are not waking up, and we're going to lose this country if a Romney gets in who's spending millions of his own dollars, or a Thompson. We are finished, and I'd like to hear your what I said off the air.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sheldon. Yeah, I mean, I was surprised at how poorly Thompson did in terms of fundraising. This guy's a joker. Believe me, once he gets under the scrutiny of this campaign, he will start to wilt. Mitt Romney's got a major problem. He's a Mormon. And the Republican Party is now owned lock, stock, and barrel by these right-wing extremists, these Christianists, and apparently they have a problem with Mormons. Which I think is, frankly, hilarious. You know, you get people saying, like, my fantastical story about how we showed up here is much more saner than your fantastical story. And, of course, Mitt Romney is just a serial liar. I mean, how many times, you think of how much campaign, how much media attention Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and John Edwards have gotten. But there still has been tremendous amount of time to talk about Mitt Romney. Just lie after lie after backtrack when he called himself a hunter. And it turns out all he did is shot a guinea pig once or something when he was 12 with an air gun. comes out and says that his sons are serving this country by trying to get him elected president? Are you kidding me? Just shocking. Just shocking. And Fred Thompson's a joke. And when his escapades in Hollywood come out, it's going to be really hilarious. This guy's, talk about an empty suit. Even Nixon, I think, called him an idiot. You know, he was the guy, he was counsel for the Republicans, I think on the special select committee that was looking into impeaching Nixon. He is the one who leaked to the Nixon administration that the committee had the tapes. So you couldn't deny it. And even still, I think Nixon called him an idiot. So I'm not terribly worried about Fred Thompson. I just hope that we get a Democratic candidate who is willing to proudly say they're a Democrat, but also willing to, I guess, throw over the establishment of the Democratic Party, the DLC, and this professional political class that exists in Washington. I don't know. We'll see. Is it 3 hours already? This time has flown by. My thanks to Mike and Kathy for letting me sit in. Everybody in Phoenix and Nova M. It's been a real pleasure. All of Mike's audience. I hope to do this again real soon. I don't know. Can I stay on or will I get in trouble here? I suppose I could keep talking into the mic, but if you guys aren't broadcasting, what's the chance? All right, folks. Mike will be back tomorrow. Is that right, Ian? All right. Mike will be back tomorrow. Thank you very much. Nova M Radio.